We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. Check out the Geek Nation Tours New York Comic Con package, combining all the excitement of the convention with a tour of the city and the coolest sights for the superhero fan. You'll recognize locations from films and books and visit geek culture sites like Jay and Silent Bob's Secret Stash. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
All right, welcome to the Edmonton Expo. First off, thank you for coming. And I also want to send a shout out to the volunteers. I just give a round of applause to them for helping us. All right, well, good morning. And I just want to welcome you to Brett Breeding, the legendary anchor of Superman, Thor, and Spider-Man, and all sorts of good things. Mm-hmm. And now you work on the licensing with DC.
Well, I do a lot of licensing. Since 2005, I've been primarily working in the licensing and marketing department. I do turnarounds for characters that go for animation, a lot of movie tie-ins. I just did a style guide for the Batman Superman movie that's coming out next year. A lot of things that go into other media as well as merchandise. A lot of the shirts you see people walking around with, and a lot of stuff that has, you know, there's a bag right across from where I'm sitting that has like Wonder Woman and Supergirl, and I'm like, all that artwork's mine, you know. So I don't ever see it until I come to one of these things, because they never send you samples. But they create catalogs that they send to people who want to use their artwork, and then people, you know, merchants, whether they're clothing merchants or peanut butter merchants or whatever, you know, they buy the right to use the characters. So I've been working on that. And then for the last 4 years, I've also been doing, for the global publishing side, I've been doing Superman children's reader books and animated interactive iPad apps. And those I'm working with a collaborator friend of mine, Ron Friends, has been doing the story layouts, and then I've been finishing the art and doing the coloring, the packaging, and unfortunately, a lot of that stuff hasn't seen publication yet because of internal politics, but, you know, it's been keeping me busy.
Now, you worked a lot in your career with both Ron Friends and Dan Jurgens. As an inker, is there a reason that you kind of gravitated towards them, or like, how much work did you have to do over top of theirs?
Well, when I came, I didn't necessarily want to start out as being an inker. I just wanted to break into comics. I wanted to work at Marvel Comics initially, so it's kind of odd that I am more of a DC guy. But I broke into the business as an assistant for Bob Layton on his run of Iron Man. And so you work for an anchor, you kind of tend to, you know, fall into that. But I was always interested in drawing and learning how to really draw. And so I ended up developing... My work ended up developing more as a finish inker. And I don't know that that's a term that means anything now, because from what I see of work that's done is pencilers who aren't inking themselves are doing very tight pencils, and inkers are coming in and pretty much just tracing off the work in ink. Back in the early days, long before I started, but in my era, a lot of guys would do breakdowns or thumbnails even. And then you would have an ink artist come in that would be a finish artist, and they would be responsible for spotting all the shadows and the blacks and the textures and, you know, truing up all the perspective. And basically, the way I always looked at it is the inker is the last guy on the creative chain and the first guy in production. And whatever ends up going into production in print, whether you get a job full penciled or you get a job breakdowns, should look the same. The difference being who is doing more of the work. So in a layout artist, and that's, if you see that term, someone that does layouts is doing, or breakdowns, is doing a more open structural breakdown pacing of the story. And a finished artist is doing the finishing the rendering and finishing the work to that completed stage. When you see like pencils and inks, and it's not always true because people don't always use the terms properly, that's usually a situation where somebody, a penciler, has put the bulk of the work in and the inker is just coming in and going over it in ink so it'll reproduce. So that having been said, I always tried to find jobs and generally was hired for jobs because I was able to draw and finish the work. I was put with pencilers who were doing less. And working with Ron, he comes from the same influences that I do. John Buscema is a huge influence for both of us. It shows in his work and less in mine. But and, of course, John Romita. We kind of meshed. It's kind of like I understand his line when I see it. And I don't know, somehow I just think we work very well together. It's kind of it's a very easy thing. Even when he gives me basic, open, practically nothing sketches, the structure and everything's there, I know what to do with it because we think kind of the same about muscle structure and our art. With somebody like Dan would do breakdowns and then do loose, but Dan was not the artist that Ron was, or the number of people. Cary Gamble, for instance, is an amazing illustrator. So I had a lot of work in finishing, even though when I worked on Ron and I was finishing, the structure was all there. It was really fleshing it out. With Dan, I was doing a lot of tweaks and fixing things and, you know, kind of correcting, trying as best I could without totally redrawing things to you know, work on his pencils to, you know, true up the anatomy and the drawing and stuff. So it was a little bit more work. But I worked with him on Superman for such a long period of time, and we both went through phases and influences. If you look at the first work that we did, I think it was a few issues he did fill in on Adventures of Superman. His pencils were very different than the stuff he was turning in by the time we were doing the Death of Superman series. And I had started out working primarily as a pen early on because of working with Cary Gamble. His pencils kind of, I don't want to say require, but it's a better fit when you work over him with pens and quills. Some artists are more brush. And with Dan was somebody I inked more with a brush. We were doing pen at first, and then if you look, you'll see the inks kind of change at some point. When the Eradicator series is where I started, I switched over to using a brush on this stuff, and things get a little bolder and have a little bit more weight and tend to pop off the page a little bit more. And then when the Death of Superman stuff started, I think it might have even been that exact issue, but Mike Carlin, Image was a big deal at the time, and they had their particular style. And he was like, it wouldn't hurt if we kind of emulated that a little bit for the marketplace. Because Superman was not nearly that popular at the time. And so there were some little things that I kind of worked into my work I wouldn't naturally have put there in order to have it fit, you know, give it a little bit more of a sensibility of that without actually copying it or trying to emulate it that much without it being different. But it's, so over the years, you know, my stuff's always evolving and changing. Right now, what I do in licensing is they don't want me to ink the way I would normally ink. They have what they call house style. And that house style, in the art director's mind, is Adam Hughes as done by Ryan Sook. And it's basically a very open line, very little rendering, with a bold outline around it. And that's pretty much it. Very clean, open style. And the problem for an inker, the problem for me has always been that they don't give that instruction to their pencilers. That, you know, so when I get pencils, and I love working with Garcia Lopez, who does such a majority of the licensing work for penciler, he does what he does on everything. And he's a penciler that has a lot of construction lines and a lot of rendering, and you got to figure out, well, what am I going to use and what do I want to discard? And it is not conducive to that style. So very often I ink it, and I find that I am pulled into inking what's there, because that's my mindset, is to try to keep what the penciler gives me, not to totally change it, especially on a guy that can draw that well. And then when I scan it in the computer and all the pencils are done, and I have just the inks, then I have to go back in and say, well, I don't need these lines, or I don't need, because I have to make it match the style. And that's a little frustrating, because when you're asked to do something that doesn't come naturally, you have to basically conform to what they think they want. And what I mean by that is, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, well, nah, this doesn't work, I don't like that. And I says, well, exactly what do you want? Well, I'll know it when I see it. They'll tell you that they want, oh, it's, we'll try to make it look like this. And then you use that as reference, and you look, you go, yeah, it looks like that. And you turn it in, they go, no, this isn't right. And I said, what do you mean it's not right? I followed the reference. So what you end up having to do is you have to learn what they think that style looks like, not really what it is. An example of this is I had a job for licensing a few years ago where some toy company came and wanted them, there's some battle bots or something. They wanted, they specifically commissioned DC to do illustrations of their toys, the characters, Green Lantern and Captain Marvel. And they wanted Jim Lee to do it, and he wasn't available. And they says, can you do Jim Lee? And I says, well, I think, you know, I can do something in a single drawing. I think I can get pretty close. So I drew it, and I used reference, and then they, well, I did my sketches, and they said, okay, well, we'll make sure you do this, and they want it to this, and they want this, and it's okay. So I used the reference, and in a couple of places, Jim's interesting from an artist standpoint because his drawing, when you break it down, is really kind of wonky. The proportions and everything are all out of whack. But the stuff is gorgeous. I'm a fan of his work. But when I had to sit down and break it down, it's like, that's not really the way you would draw an arm. But they want Jim Lee. So I was copying what I had for reference. And when the client got it, their notes came back, and they said, oh, yeah, well, this is good and that's good, but, you know, it's still not exactly what we were looking for. I mean, like this arm, it doesn't look enough like Jim Lee. And I had to tell my art director, well, I don't know how that's possible. I showed her the reference because I swiped Jim Lee. I took it right from Jim Lee. That's how Jim draw. But when they don't know it's Jim Lee, it's like they don't realize that's really how he drew the arm. So it was like they wanted me to fix something to not look like Jim Lee, even though the instruction for the job was we needed to look like Jim Lee. So you have to learn what the client or the art director thinks they want as opposed to what they tell you they want, because the two are very rarely the same.
That's fantastic. So we're going to go to audience questions in just a moment, but I'm going to ask you one question about you worked on some of the bigger events in comic books. I mean,
I don't know how that happened. Yeah.
You know, Spider-Man's black costume. You know, what was it like to be there at those moments and be able to kind of, you know, just be in comics working on those seminal events?
Well, I get these questions from fans a lot and stuff because it's Monday morning quarterbacking. Everybody thinks we planned it or you knew it was going to, you know, it's big now in retrospect. When I got the Spider-Man, I was a huge deadline risk back in the early days. I was a procrastinator and, you know, working for Bob. Bob was the same way, and so I wasn't very disciplined. So I was all, and I also took my time. It didn't come easy. I didn't have a lot of confidence early on, so I took too long to do work. And so that's why, if you go back and look, I didn't have any really long runs until I got on Thor and then Superman. Because in the early days, I would bounce around. I actually started at Marvel as the new regular anchor on the Avengers. But after a few issues and deadlines caught up, you know, and then I started doing pieces, and so I moved around a lot. Spider-Man was something that just came around. They thought it was a bad idea, I think, because it was done for a toy tie-in, giving him the black costume. It wasn't done for any real great creative purpose. It wasn't like somebody said, it wasn't a marketing purpose other than the toys. It wasn't like, we'll put him in a new costume and sell millions of books. It was like, no, we got to put him in a black costume because they want to do a toy that's going to be different, you know, that kind of thing. So nobody thought it was going to be anything. It's actually the first time I ever worked with Ron Friends. And the editor actually hired me, but didn't want me to do any of my backgrounds. He said, I just want you to do the figures, because he wanted to make sure I could finish the job within the schedule. And I said, okay. And on the very first page, it was a newspaper. And I am not good at it. I see the newspaper, and I was one of these guys, the old shorthand in comics where guys would just go with a brush and draw lines, didn't work for me on a big splash page where it's mostly a newspaper. So used to have stuff back then called Zip-A-Tone or Letraset lettering, and you know, you didn't have computers. And they used to publish a sheet that was, it's ellipsis something, so it was all Latin. But it was basically for typesetters and graphic designers that were creating mock-ups. It was gibberish, but it was all typed up that at a glance it looked like columns of real newspaper print. And so I bought a sheet of this and I pasted it all in and, you know, did the newspaper because it was just all these little heads and then a newspaper. And it didn't take me any time at all because I just cut it out and pasted it in. And I almost had the job taken away from me when the pages showed up because he was like, I told you not to do the backgrounds. So I had this. That was my experience on the black costume at the time. We never saw that as anything other than, you know, we were like, actually, we were disappointed. I know I was, and I believe Ron was too, because we wanted to do Spider-Man in the Spider-Man costume. It wasn't until it hit and it became this big deal, and now, you know, going back and looking at it, it was such an event, first time you ever had a new costume, that it's become a big deal. So it didn't really feel like anything at the time. Superman, on the other hand, people tend to think that was orchestrated. And the interesting history behind that is when I started on Superman, there were three titles, and they were, if not the, one of the lowest selling titles at DC. Nobody was buying or reading Superman. But it's their flagship character. And so DC kept it as what it was, their loss leader. At the time, all the other books were going up to $1.25, and they were going up. They locked in. We were still only 75 cents. And they got, some incredible creators. I mean, Jerry Ordway, Roger Stern was, you know, George Perez. All these people were on these books. And they were doing it out of love for the character and the environment that Mike Carlin had created that was so creator-friendly and collaborative. And it was affecting everybody's income because the books didn't sell enough to make much royalties. And with the book being 50 cents less, you know, so it was like you've got some of the top talent in the industry working on books that aren't selling and you're keeping the price exaggerated low. So we started selling books. We started raising the numbers because of the storylines and things we were doing. And they took a little notice of that. And that was the other thing. In the early days, Mike Carlin begged them to try to put some of what we had done, some of the storylines, some that came before me, into trade paperbacks. And DC had almost a policy that they didn't do that because Superman wouldn't sell. No one would buy a Superman trade paperback. So there were no trade paperbacks of Superman material from the modern era that, you know, while we were on the books until we started making these sales. And then we had, the storylines went and it was, okay, we're gonna reveal Superman to Lois Lane. And I was supposed to ink that issue. And Mike had decided he wanted to put me on Dan Jurgens Dan as an anchor. He was, I don't forget what shifted, but he was shifting people around. Jerry was moving books and, you know, everything was getting shifted. And I was like, well, Mike, I mean, this is gonna be a big deal. You know, he's, nah, nobody's going to be paying attention. It's going to be a little blip. It's not going to be a big deal. I really need you over here. I was like, okay. So I go over and I do adventures. It hits. He's on Entertainment Tonight. It's all in the news. I turn on the local news and it's, oh, yes, Lois Lane finally finds out, you know, and all this. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So it wasn't a big deal. But a year and a half later, I get in the mail a check from Bob McLeod apologizing that he inked the book that I should have inked. Apparently, something had gotten said in a heated discussion about how, you know, Brett was supposed to ink that book. He felt guilty, and so he sent me half his royalties. And it wasn't a lot, but it was for Superman at the time. It was a few hundred dollars, and we weren't used to that on Superman. And I was like, I can't take this money. I called Mike, and I said, what did you do? He just sent me money. And he said, he did something, and he, you know, and I told him, you know, he couldn't do that. And I said, because he didn't take it away from me. So anyway, we go a little bit longer and it's, you know, our stories. And they would bring us together. When Superman books were unique, and I think they were they worked the way they did, because they would bring us in as a group. I mean, the inkers, the colorists, no one was ever doing this. The writers, for like 3-4 day summits somewhere, they sent us, the first one was to Florida, where they had us set up as extras on the Superboy TV show. And while we were there, we had conferences where we fleshed out a year's worth of stories. Mike would put a big chart on the wall. And And I apologize. I'll get the complete answer to your question, but I'm giving you a little history, a stream of consciousness here. But I can't emphasize enough how little we were thought of in comics to where it ended up with the death of Superman. But so we would do our stories and get together and do that kind of stuff. They treated us great. But then we ended up doing the storyline where he proposes to Lois. Well, this isn't going to be a big deal. You know, okay, we had, you know, it's not going to be as big as the last one. Oh, man, he's even on bigger national news. And it's like, wow, it's getting attention. And now DC's coming in and saying, you know, you guys are really doing, so we're going to do a trade paperback. We want to put this together. And we're going to add a fourth book, right? Man of Steel is going to come along. And we thought, well, that's, you know, how could it get any bigger than that? Well, then ABC comes and says, we want to do this Superman show, Lois and Clark. And issue 75 was supposed to be the wedding of Lois and Clark. And they specifically asked us not to do that. They wanted to get the show up and running, and they wanted to coordinate the wedding with the show. And DC, okay, fine. So we got called into New York for an emergency weekend, and what are we going to do? We had no idea what we were going to do. And Dan Jurgens came in with this sketch of this character and an idea that he was trying to play with an idea to come up with some villain who really was a match for Superman. It didn't feel not just like Brainiac with the brain or magic or something that could go toe-to-toe with him just in brute strength and really take him, you know, take him down. And Jerry Ordway threw out at some point, and this is how I remember it. I know other people have said they remember it differently. But Jerry Ordway was like, well, let's just kill him. And Jerry had said that in a lot of meetings as kind of a joke, but somehow in the context of the conversation that day, it got taken a little more seriously. And it was like, well, will they let us do that? I mean, he's on peanut butter jars and Underoos. They're not going to kill, you know, this big licensing cash cow. And we thought, well, let's see what we come up with. And we worked out the story. And they went to the people that be. Jeanette Kahn, who was a publisher at the time, was a very big supporter of Mike Harlan and the Superman books. She was the one that let us, you know, was behind us on all these meetings and sending us to be extras and all that kind of stuff. And she was like, let's do it. Let's see what we do. And then they came up with this whole, you know, the black bag thing, you know. And again, we didn't know what to expect. We didn't think it was going to be a big deal because people really weren't. We really still weren't on the radar regularly, you know, except for these little blips. And the day it hit, I was doing a shop appearance for a friend that owned a chain of stores back east. I'm from Delaware on the east coast of the U.S. And CNN had contacted him and said, we'd like you to come in and interview you, we'd do a little segment about this Death of Superman stuff. And he said, well, I have the guy that did the book coming into my stores today. And they said, oh, well, that'd be great. Can we have him? So somewhere out there's footage of me on CNN looking like a deer caught in headlights. Because they put you in a little room with boxes and stuff in a backdrop. There's nobody in there, and there's an earpiece. And there, at least I have somebody I can interact to. And I'm looking literally at a wall that's got like a camera and a light and a wah, 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 wah in my ear. And I'm like, you know, it was a very surreal moment. And anyway, we went to the one shop appearance. I had two to do. We did one in Woodbridge, New Jersey, and it was a store, and it was nuts. It was crazy for like 3 hours, just nonstop kids. And then we went to Franklin Mills Mall outside of Philadelphia, which was like one of the biggest malls of the time on the East Coast. And his store was right there at the food court. And it was like a Beatles concert. It was like standing room only, the entire food court in the hall, police everywhere, every local affiliate, ABC, Fox, CBS, was all there with cameras and stuff. And I was the only guest. And I just signed for like 4 hours nonstop books. And, you know, that night we're on the phone like, this is nuts. Well, they sold out the black bag like that day. And they wanted to go back to print. They printed 1.5 million copies of the book and sold out the first day, and they couldn't go back to print because there's all those little tchotchkes they put in there, the ribbons and the stuff, and they couldn't reproduce those. So the regular book, they just kept doing, I think it did five print runs or whatever, and it went nuts. And we had no idea. I had one guy from Fox News tell me, well, I know Paul Libitz. This is all some big marketing campaign, right? And I was like, trust me. And he didn't want to believe me. And I said, I was in the room. We didn't think they'd let us do it. It was kind of a Hail Mary pass of something we had to do because we couldn't do the wedding, which was, it had already been fleshed out for like 7 months. And, but I says, but if anybody here thinks that they're going to let Superman go away forever because of every, you know, the merchandising and everything, then you're deluding yourself, because we don't believe that'll happen, but we don't know where we're going to go from here. And we took a hiatus. We stopped publication on the books because we were really thinking that it was going to be the end of Clark Kent, and we would try to find a new creation for Superman. We would really try to totally come up with something new. And that's when it led to everybody kind of came to the same ideas, like, well, we have this Superman. And when everybody came in with their idea for Superman, that's where the, well, let's every team do their own Superman. Let's do that. And that's how that storyline, The Return, came about. It was like, we really do need to bring Clark back because of the history, and, you know, and we weren't going to stay with the status quo. We still wanted to mix it up, but we still needed to go back there. Nothing up to that point had been orchestrated or manufactured in any kind of marketing. It was just guys in a room spitballing stories, the best stories we could come up with to try to do something to fill in a space we had nothing for at the last minute. As soon as it became popular, sales department was getting involved. Marketing was getting involved. Let's do a foil cover. Let's do a this. Let's do a that. Let's do this campaign. Let's do. And it all came, became so commercial about turning it into that over and over again. And the atmosphere changed a little bit on the books. People were doing so many guest appearances and book signings and so many other things on the outside, trying to take advantage of the popularity, and that it was the work. I thought my work suffered for sure. I mean, I was going on so many trips. When they had the hurricane in Florida that took out Homestead, they sent us down there for a week. It's a whole mess of the Superman people. There were three crews of us that went in teams of three to all the comic shops all around Miami and the Homestead area to help raise money for the appearances and stuff. And it was like, just don't worry about the work, you know, let's go, you know. And then licensing, well, they got this artwork, and they wanted me, I mean, I was having trouble doing 22 pages a month, and 1 month I did 15 pieces for licensing on top of the work, you know. Something had to give. It was an amazing time, and but it was also very frustrating, because they were like, oh, yeah, well, we got to make this big again. And it took a little bit away from it, so, but we did have a great run. Dan and I got to do the Doomsday thing, which for us was the Doomsday Hunter Prey. What do they call those miniseries?
Prestige format.
Thank you. We were so excited, because it's also people today that are in comics don't remember that back then all that stuff was printed on crap paper. You know, that newsprint and the color, you know, I mean, 64 colors. There was no computer coloring. There wasn't any good paper. And Prestige was that, at least, you know. And we got Gregory Wright, who's like one of my favorite colorists. He's like amazing to do it. And so from an artist standpoint, that was like, you know, a cherry on the top of the icing right there. It was like, wow, look, we get to do this. And unfortunately for me, once I finished those three issues, I was getting ready to start back in on the books. The pages had just started to come in at the end of May, and I had them for a week. When I had a big accident, I had a fall, and I did nerve damage to my hand and my arm and my back and messed myself up. UPS, and I love to tell this because I hate UPS, but they put a package of my books, my complimentary books, right in front of my front door and hid it under a doormat, no note or anything. And when I walked out my front door to go get the mail, I slipped on it, and I fell down onto a brick and concrete patio and just messed myself up. And immediately I was having trouble controlling the pen and everything. So that's why you don't see me on a lot of Superman books after that. They moved me on to Man of Tomorrow at some point to do quarterly books. It was tough because the books were really selling at that time, and I was missing out on a lot of royalties. But and Ron Frenz had been brought over to Superman for me. Mm-hmm. Because somebody had left, and I suggested to Mike, I says, man, what about Ron? He just left the book, and he's free. I said, that would be great. And he brought him over, and I think we did 11 pages somewhere, you know, a year into his run. But I never got to work on him on that. But so that's why, if you look, That was kind of the last work I did at DC was Man of Tomorrow. So I hope that answered the question in a real roundabout, long way. But it was an amazing time that happened, and we didn't know it. And when we were caught up in it, we didn't really know what was happening. And of course, now we're all old gray-haired farts looking back and going, "That was 20 years ago. What happened?" You know, the time really has flown by. But I will say about the death of Superman, whatever you think about the story or the product itself, I have had more people that I have met over the last few years that I've been doing some appearances again that got their, that was the first comic they read. They got them into comics. It was that popular that it did bring a lot of readership, not just buying that book, but readership that stayed into comics. So, you know, if nothing else, that was one of the best things about it.
Awesome. Well, very informative. Any questions from the audience right now? There is a mic. Okay. All right. You first. There's a microphone over there. We'll see. But,
I don't know if they hear me on this or not. Sitting back here.
Were you ever in anime? Like, were you ever into anime?
Anime? Yeah. No, I've been strictly in comics. The closest I've come to animation is doing these interactive iPad apps, which started out when they asked me if I wanted to do them. The samples they gave me were very much like the kids' books. They were drawn in a anime kind of kid cartoony style, and they'd have like Robin waving a flag, and then the animation was moving the arm here and down, you know. And I thought, sure, you know, cape waving, Superman static, but his cape would wave like he's flying. And I get my first script, and it's Superman Topples Titano, written by Louise Simonson. And I hired Ron to do the story layouts, and Ron does have an animation background. And I said, somehow we have to do these animations. They told me we're going to be doing like an arm moving. Well, at some point, Titano has to do sign language. And the Daily Planet building has to spin. I says, I am not drawing that building, that globe with the lettering, you know, a dozen times so that the people that would assemble the artwork could animate it, right? They can't just take a flat drawing and animate it. So I actually hired a friend that does 3D work to build me a 3D model so that I could draw it once, and then I could use that thing to, you know, create animations for it. But we'd have to draw like Clark Kent raising his glasses or flying out a window. I mean, I says, you know, I'm a one-man operation here, and you want stuff like Pixar or something, you know? So that's as close as I've come to animation or anything like that. But I've done pretty much everything in comics. I've created characters and done some writing and well, not actually scripting, but story development and plotting and coloring and even a little bit of lettering and so, kind of a jack of all trades.
Awesome. All right, we have another question right here.
When you left Spider-Man there, the Gang War series, part one, you and Tom DeFalco and Ron Frank sort of all left at the same time. The identity of the Hobgoblin was confused, and they were suddenly planting the Spidey and Mary Jane wedding on you guys. Did all this have an effect on you, and how did you deal with it?
Well, the interesting thing about that is, Jim Owsley hired me to do work on Rich Buckler on the Jane DeWolf thing. And Ron and Tom were already established on Spider-Man with Joe Rubenstein inking that. And they hired David Michelinie, a friend of mine, to do Web of Spider-Man. And they had us all in for a summit, and all this was set up, you know, what we were going to do. And none of it ever really happened, which is kind of the odd thing, all these stories that were planned, all this idea. At some point, I got a phone call. At some point something happened with Joe Rubenstein. I don't know what exactly it was, but he got pushed out, or he got a problem with the editor. And I had done a few little helpful fill-in things with Ron, and Owsley wanted me to work on Ron and put us together as a team because we were meshing really well at that point. And the few things we had done he really liked. So then I was a regular on Ron. I was part of the official team, supposedly. And I don't know how long that went. Only a few issues, as I recall. Probably longer than that, because I actually penciled. The only thing I've actually penciled entire stories is there's two issues of Spider-Man that I penciled off of Ron's thumbnails and inked. And so I did those, and then it was, I think, I forget what the issue was. A couple of issues later, I come home one day, the answering machine, Jim Owsley, the editor, saying, Brett, I had to let Tom, you know, you'll probably hear this at some point, but, he says, Tom and Ron are no longer going to be on Spider-Man, but I want you to know that, you know, you're still the anchor on the book, and I want you to be, you know, I want you to know everything's fine and not to worry about that. What the heck? And I had developed a very good friendship with Ron. We were like, when we met, we were like brothers. Were we separated at birth or something? You know, when we first got to know each other, there were so many overlaps in our histories and stuff, and we just hit it off. And so I called him up, and I said, dude, what, I just got this. And he's, I said, what happened? Why'd you guys quit? Quit? We didn't quit. We got fired. And supposedly, you know, depending on who you listen to, I think the truth is probably in there somewhere in the middle, but Owsley apparently got rid of them because of scheduling issues. And yet they were further ahead on their deadlines than anybody else was. So there was something political going on with Jim Owsley. He was always trying to prove himself as an editor. He was kind of like a darling of Jim Shooter. Jim really believed him and put him in that position. And he put him on the Spider-Man books. And this is what I was told, and I've heard this directly from Jim. He put him on there. He thought he had potential to be a great editor, but he put him on the Spider-Man books in charge of those because everybody at the time that was writing a Spider-Man book was an editor, a seasoned editor. Tom DeFalco, Roger Stern, at that point he was given the job, right? He fired Roger Stern. I forget who the other, Louise Simonson, I think, was writing the other book at the time. He got rid of Louise, like very early on, apparently. So Tom eventually was the last one to go, but that's what happened. He, you know, so there's, you know, you don't know really why it happened. He says the deadlines, a lot of people, you know, I think Tom and Ron feel it was because he didn't want Tom, you know, working with him. No one really knows, but yeah, they were let go. And I said, well, at that point, I felt like I was part of a team. And as an anchor, and, you know, working with Bob Layton as I did, Bob at the time was very rare for an inker because he was co-plotting Iron Man with Dave Michelinie. He started penciling while he was on the books with Dave, and he was a true collaborator. And usually the inker is just sending the pages, and you know, you're not really part of that. That's usually, you know, the penciler and the inker are the true collaborators in creating a story. And I kind of liked that because I had a lot of ideas and a lot of things that I wanted to do. And I had come by inking kind of accidentally, so, and I liked it, because I liked the idea of, I'm probably a little too detail-oriented, but the idea of inking, that it's, that's the finished art, it's done, and I can kind of control what it looks like at the end. So I kind of liked being an inker, and so I didn't pursue penciling, but I thought, hey, I'm hooked in with a guy that, you know, we mesh well, and, you know, so I left the book. I said, well, I'm going to go with these guys. And it didn't quite work out that way, because really what I found out the hard way was Tom and Ron were the team, and Ron and I were friends, and as long as, you know, the editor wanted to put me on Ron, that was great, but nobody was going around saying, like, you know, well, you know, we want to do this together, or, you know, it was, so I ended up finding other work again here and there until eventually, Thor got offered to us, and we just did a fill-in, that Secret Wars kind of a tie-in, and because that was Walt's book, and you know, following Walt Simonson on anything is kind of a ridiculous proposition, but it was Thor, and Ron has been a penciler that's gone through a lot of artist phases, influences, and you know, he left Spider-Man, he was kind of a Romita influence there, but on Thor, Buscema was coming through, and of course, John Buscema was my biggest, you know, hero in comics as well, so it's like, wow, this is going to be great. Thor was always my favorite character, these are always my favorite books, and now we're going to get to do that, and just for one issue, and they liked what we did, and Walt, I guess, had decided to permanently leave the book, and they said, would you like to do Thor? And we're like, yes, you know, so we did it together, and we stayed on that, until it became a deadline issue. And the reason I'm off the books, you know, got basically let go on that was because Tom and Ron weren't able to keep up on their deadlines. So they kept getting further behind, and I was not somebody that could do a book in 2 weeks. And it was getting to that point where the stuff was coming in so late to me that I couldn't do it. I mean, I was struggling to get a book done in 4 weeks. So I was kind of pushed out. And that was kind of bitter for me at that point. And I was going through a lot of changes. I was living in Delaware, and I was moving to Atlanta when this happened. This was April, and I was moving in June. And I didn't know what I was going to do, and I called Jerry Ordway, who was a friend, and asked him if he knew of any work. And he said, he had just come from this big Superman summit. They had had some celebration in Ohio where they had their first real summit, George Perez and, Kurt Swan, and they were getting ready. George had signed on to do 12 issues of Action. They were getting that together and the stories they were going to do. And he said, your name came up at the meeting that you'd be perfect for George. Really? They don't have... He says, now give Mike a call. Well, Mike started as Mark Grunewald's assistant editor about the same week that I got my assignment on the Avengers at Marvel. So Mike and I have known each other since we started there. And he was in my wedding. We've been friends all this time. But we've had our, issues because of deadlines. And he loved my work, but it was always, I was a guy that would be 2 weeks, you wouldn't see anything, and in the last 2 weeks, the stuff would come, I built up a head of steam. And he hated that. He wanted to see that trickle the whole time. I don't know who does that, but that's what he wanted to see. So anyway, I called him, and I was like, hey, Mike, it's Brett. I says, just talk to Jerry. He says, you're looking for an anchor on George Perez. He goes, oi. And I says, what? I says, did you get somebody? He says, he's auditioning people. He's got two guys that have done samples. Because what George wanted to do, he didn't want to pencil the book. He was doing thumbnails, just loose like balloon figures. And he would blow them up on the boards. And they needed somebody that could finish penciling the job and ink it. And he asked me if I was willing to turn in samples. So I inked the first 3 pages on vellum. I think it was, no one actually has said this, but I've been told that, by Mike, that I think he's being diplomatic, but I think it was a technicality. I think he wanted me, from what Jerry's told me, they talked about me before. They wanted me on the book. George, when he saw the sample, we got to have Brett if he can do it. So I was very lucky. The timing was great. And, so they say when one door closes, another opens. I mean, the best thing that happened to me in my life was that phone call, because, I've been on Superman ever since in some capacity or another. And but George was not going to start the penciling for about 9 months. So that's what led to, Mike was like, well, how would you like to work on Cary Gamble and Superman? That was like, wow, I didn't even care if I ever got to George, because working with Cary was like a dream. I love the Superman. But so that's a little more history than you asked for, but that I can't tell you any more about the gang war thing because I left at that point. And the wedding, what I know about the wedding is because David Michelinie wrote it. And like I said, he's very good friends with us, with my family. And he says he was forced to write it. That was their call. The creative people didn't come up with that. That was, again, a marketing thing that was pushed on him. And I think it was rewritten heavily too, because by Jim Shooter, because they wanted something very specific, and there were a lot of rewrites to get something to fit their marketing mold as opposed to creatively. So,
all right. Well, we don't
answer your question.
We don't have any more time for questions, but I'll tell you right now, Brett is at his table for most of the day.
I'll be here to the end of the day. Yeah.
Excellent. So if you have any questions, go by and talk to him. As you can see, he's an awesome guy. I want you all to thank Brett Breeding for coming out and gracing the event tonight.
Thank you.
And also, just for his work. This guy's put in a lot of time and done some great stuff that we've all enjoyed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to the Edmonton Expo. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for coming.